ॐ नमः भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 23, Chapter 53, Text number 24. Api mai anvadhyatma दृष्ट्वा किञ्चित् जुगुप्सितम् मत्पाणिग्रहणे नूनम् नायाति हि कृतोद्यमा। अपि मयि अन्वद्यात्मा दृष्ट्वा किञ्चित् जुगुप्सितम् मत्पाणि ग्रहणे नूनम् नायाति हि कृतोद्यमा। अपि मयि अन्वद्यात्मा दृष्ट्वा किञ्चि जुगुप्सितम् मत्पाणि ग्रहणे नूनम् नायाति हि कृतोद्यमा। माताजीस, अपि परहैप्स मई इन मी अन्वद्य फॉल्टलेस आत्मा ही हुज बॉडी एंड माइंड दृष्ट्वा सीइंग किंचित समथिंग जुगुप्सितम कंटेम्प्टेबल मत माय पाणी हैंड ग्रहणे For the taking, Nunam, indeed, Na Ayati has not come. He suddenly, Kratudyama, even though originally intending to do so. Translation and purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. Translation. Perhaps the faultless Lord, even while preparing to come here, saw something contemptible in me and therefore has not come to take my hand. Purport. Princess Rukmini boldly invited Shri Krishna to kidnap her. When Rukmini did not see him come, she naturally feared that he had rejected her proposal, perhaps finding some unacceptable quality in her. As expressed here, the Lord himself is anavadya, faultless, and if he saw some fault in Rukmini, she would be an unworthy bride for him. It was natural for the young princess to feel such anxiety. Furthermore, if Shri Krishna had actually made this decision, it would be natural for the Brahmana to fear Rukmini's reaction, were he to bring her the news, and that would explain why he had not come. Pamagyanatimirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurunmilidham yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manobhishtam sthapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa gadamayam dadati svapadhantikam vandeham shri guru shri yuta padakamalam shri gurun vaishnavamsha shri rupam sagrajatam sahagana raghunadhanitam dvam sajivam sadvaitam sabadhutam parijana sahitam krishna chaitanya devam shri radha krishna padan sahagana lalita shri vishakhanvitamsya he krishna karuna sindho dinabandho jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Devrindavaneshwari Rishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Haripriye Vancha Galvadarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevacha Padidanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shrivasadi Ghora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. Actually, somehow I thought that I had to speak on text number 24, chapter 54. So anyway, I'm supposed to speak on chapter 53, text 24, but all verses in the Bhagavatam are connected. So here in this verse, Rukmini is expressing her anxiety. Apimai anavadyatma. She is calling Krishna as anavadyatma, as faultless. And she is thinking that perhaps Krishna found some fault in me, and that is the reason he is not coming. But the fact is, she, being the goddess of fortune, she is also faultless, and so is Krishna. Both Krishna and Rukmini are faultless. And by hearing the wonderful pastime, we become purified. At the same time, there are so many other characters in this mega drama who are full of faults. And from their faults also, there is much we can learn. So I was thinking that if a behavioral psychologist were to analyze this complete episode of Krishna kidnapping Rukmini, and even prior to it, how would his report look like? the report would be that almost everyone here except Rukmini and Krishna are suffering from conformational bias. Rukmi is suffering from Dunning-Kruger effect, Naim's cynicism and in-group bias. Jarasandha is suffering from fundamental attribution error, probability neglect and Byers Stockholm syndrome. Shishupal is suffering from halo effect. So this would be roughly the report of a behavioral psychologist if he were to analyze this complete drama of Rukmini getting kidnapped by Krishna. Now, modern science has analyzed that within the human brain there are 10 to the power 16 processes that happen every second. Very powerful processor, more powerful than Intel or anything. But still, modern science has recognized that we are susceptible to many thinking mistakes or cognitive biases. So this era of experimental psychology started somewhere in the 19th century, and since then, having conducted extensive research, they have come up with so many kinds of malfunctioning of the mind. The way the mind analyzes things and many times makes mistakes. And these are called cognitive biases. So what are they? Now, one is, as I was just now telling, that most characters in this particular episode, Shishupal, Rukmi, Jarasandha and Dantavakra, they are suffering from conformational bias. So what is conformational bias? Conformational bias is also called cognitive dissonance. What this basically means is we tend to proactively look for information which falls in line with our belief system. We believe something and our tendency is to proactively look for more knowledge that confirms what I already believe. And we tend to neglect other information. We tend to focus more on information which falls in line with our belief. And also, we tend to associate more with people who have similar belief system. For example, say, you know, if I believe that it is okay to eat outside when you are out to preach because it's more convenient and it's more convenient for preaching. So if I believe that it's okay to eat outside when it's like in a kind of emergency situation when I am out to preach, then I tend to look for information which supports my belief. Now I'll find plenty of quotations from Prabhupada's books or Prabhupada's conversations, especially Prabhupada's conversations or lectures, or we will find plenty of examples of senior devotees doing the same thing. And we will tend to associate more with people who think like us, okay, who also feel that it's okay to eat outside when you are out to preach. So all these things happen many a times subconsciously. So this is called conformational bias. So in this particular episode we can see that Now, Shishupal, Rukmi, etc., they were suffering from this problem. They were envious of Krishna. They had wrong understanding of Krishna. And they tended to look for information that conformed with their belief. And they tended to associate with other people who held the same belief system. A few days ago, His Holiness Radha Swami Maharaj was making the point that many devotees were coming to Bhishmaka's palace and speaking about Krishna. But it's interesting that upon meeting the same people, Rukmini developed her attraction for Krishna. Tvai achyuta vishati chittam apatrapam me, she says, that Krishna, you have entered into my mind because I have heard so much about you. And Rukmi was exposed to the same people who were speaking about Krishna. But what happened? His belief that Krishna is bad, Krishna is wrong, that Krishna is a corrupt person, got more and more confirmed. So this is a typical example of confirmational bias. Another cognitive bias is fundamental attribution error. Now, what is this fundamental attribution error? Suppose somebody gives me a glass of hot milk. I drop it. I take the glass of milk and I drop it. So what is the immediate reaction? I will tell, you should have told me that it's hot. Or you should have told me that the milk is filled to the top, so that, I'd be careful while holding it. I thought the top of the milk, or top of the glass, the milk wasn't there. So I held the top and the milk was there. It was so hot that I dropped it. Right? So the immediate reaction is, we give a situational explanation that the situation was wrong and so I dropped the milk. Because the milk was too hot, it was filled to the top, or I wasn't told, so we blame the situation. A situational explanation is given when we do a mistake. And suppose someone else drops a glass of milk. What is the immediate conclusion? This person is irresponsible. What do you call it? He's not careful. This person is not careful. He doesn't know how to hold the glass of milk properly. The tendency is to give a personality-based explanation. When we do a mistake, the tendency is to give a situational explanation. But when someone else does a mistake, I hope you're getting it. When we do a mistake, we tend to give a situational explanation. But when someone else does a mistake, we tend to give a personality-based explanation. The point is, I don't want to take the blame. So this is called fundamental attribution error. And we see in the case of Jarasandha, typically, after a few verses, he's going to explain to Shishupal that why I got defeated 17 times from Krishna? Because the situation wasn't right. Time wasn't on my side. That's why I lost it. But how come Krishna won? Krishna ran away on the 18th time. How did Krishna get defeated on the 18th war? Because he's a coward. So when it comes to Krishna, he's giving a personality-based explanation. When it comes to himself, he's giving a situational explanation. This is called fundamental attribution error, and Jarasandha is suffering from it. And then there is Dunning-Kruger effect. What is Dunning-Kruger effect? unskilled individuals are likely to suffer from illusory superiority. Okay. We all have this experience that when we become devotees, when we just start to become devotees, we tend to think that we have become pure devotees. We tend to think that we are very pure and we are almost on the level of pure devotees. This is called Dunning-Kruger effect. That is, when we are unskilled in a particular field, when we are new to a particular field, we tend to overestimate our capabilities in that field. Because we are new to that field, we think we know so much. But the same individual, when he learns more about that particular skill or about that particular field, in due course of time, he understands that there is so much in this field and I know so little. He becomes humble. So this is called the Dunning-Kruger effect, that a new person in any field generally feels that he knows more or he has accomplished too much. And almost all demons who came to kill Krishna in Vrindavan and Rukmini in this case, they suffer from Dunning-Kruger effect. All of them had some kind of mystic power. Putana had some kind of mystic power. So had Trinavarta, Aghasur, Bakasur. They didn't know that Krishna is Yogeshwar. Trinavarta thought that he had that Mahima Siddhi to such an extent that he could go up and just throw Krishna. But he didn't know that Krishna was much more advanced in the same field than he was. So he was suffering from Dunning-Kruger effect. And then there is... Okay, this is the last one we will discuss. Buyer's Stockholm Syndrome or post-purchase rationalization. What this basically means is, typically when you buy a commodity or you make a decision, after some time you realize that that was a wrong choice or that I did a mistake. But then we find it so difficult to accept that mistake that we somehow rationalize, saying that after all it was a good decision. This are the reasons. At the back of the mind we know that we did a mistake. But at the same time, we don't want to accept it. And we want to rationalize the wrong choice that we made. Right? Kamsa is a typical example. You know, he killed the 6 children of Devaki. And afterwards, when Yogamaya told him that the person who is going to kill you is already born somewhere else, Kamsa understood. He did a mistake by killing 6 children. But then he started doing post-purchase rationalization by saying that, you know, after all it's the law of karma and I'm not to be blamed. It is providence. It was their own karma, etc., etc. Now, we see that modern science accepts that these are mistakes. These are thinking mistakes or biases. That means it's not right. These things are wrong. They are not right. And we have a tendency to do it. So what is the solution to overcome it? We definitely don't want to suffer from these problems. So the solution which is generally given by modern science is you should be aware of this. If you are aware of this, then there will be less tendency to do this, to succumb to these errors. But that doesn't really seem to be the case, because many a times we know that we have these deficiencies, but still we fall prey to it. And another solution which modern science proposes is go for the hardcore scientific method. go for the hardcore scientific method to analyze things, to analyze life. Go for the scientific approach of life, that is rational empiricism. And then you won't be susceptible. You'll become more scientific. If you are more scientific in your thought, you won't be susceptible to these mistakes. That's the scientific approach to the whole problem. But then what we observe is even the scientists who actually profess science, many a times they're also subjected to these mistakes, to these biases. For example, you know, confirmational bias. As I was speaking, we tend to look for information which falls in line with our belief system. You know, a few years ago, Dhrutakarma Prabhu came up with the book Forbidden Archaeology. And the book is about how the whole archaeologist community, they have the tendency to fall prey to confirmational bias. They tend to look for information, they tend to dig for information, archaeological information, which falls in line with the theory of evolution as proposed by Darwin. And then post-purchase rationalization. Now, scientists are realizing that many of the scientific inventions or discoveries are having a negative effect on the environment, but still, we tend to do post-purchase rationalization, saying that, but still, somehow, you know, life is much better than it was before. Okay, we are living in a world where the water is polluted, the air is polluted, the earth is polluted, everything is polluted, and, you know, life on earth could be threatened because of the environmental crisis. That's okay, but still, life is much better now. So this is a typical example of post-purchase rationalization. So the point is, if following science is a method of overcoming these thinking mistakes or confirmational biases, etc., then how is it that the scientific community themselves is falling prey to these errors? So what's the solution to the whole problem? Now, it's very interesting that the whole analysis of how we tend to make mistakes in thinking, the whole science emerged somewhere in the 19th century, but way back in the 16th century, Jiva Goswami, in his Tattva Sandarbha, he points out these mistakes which the mind is prone to commit. And he classifies them into pramada, brahma and vipralipsa. And the interesting thing is, not only does he, what he has documented in the 16th century fall in line with what modern science is telling, but it provides an additional insight. Now, Jiva Goswami in his Tattva Sandarbha, after pointing out these mistakes, he comments about the scientific method, that is Anuman Praman. Now, many a times we think that Anuman Praman is guesswork, but no. Jiva Goswami's analysis of Anuman Praman is, it is a scientific method. He gives the steps involved: Pratigya, Hetu, Udharana, Upanaya and Nigamana. Now, what are these steps? I'll just briefly tell them. It's a little bit technical. You know, suppose there's a liquid which is placed on the table, and I want to find whether it is acidic or basic, right? So first of all, my hypothesis is it's a base. So that step of hypothesis is called pratigya. What is the evidence? Because it is turning red litmus into blue. That is the evidence. That Jiva Goswami calls hetu. And just because it has turned red litmus into blue, how can we call it a base? Because there are so many examples of bases turning red litmus into blue and acids turning blue litmus into red. So on the base of these examples, we understand. So these examples, Jiva Goswami calls Udharan. And based upon Hetu and Udharan, we come to a conclusion, that is Nigamana. That indeed, this particular liquid is not an acid, it's a base. So what Jiva Goswami says is Anuman is the scientific method. And Jiva Goswami says that Anuman Praman ultimately depends upon, he gives an additional insight. And that additional insight is, this Anuman Praman is based upon Shabda. How is it? Because he says that if I am saying that in the past many bases have turned red litmus into blue and many acids have turned blue litmus into red, I am getting this information based upon Shabda. So whatever scientific evidence we might present in the form of Anuman, ultimately it gains weight or weightage based upon Shabda. So that is the additional information, additional insight that Jiva Goswami gives. Now if you see the modern world also, the paradox is, we speak so much about direct empirical evidence, but so much of our life is more and more becoming dependent upon Shabda. Isn't it? Now for example, e-commerce is fast picking up in India. Now, in the West, most people, they buy things online. And in India, that hasn't picked up so much. But what is online shopping? Now, you buy a product without seeing it, without touching it. How did you make the decision to buy that product then? Based on testimonials or reviews. Reviews from people you haven't seen or met. So based upon that Shabda, you make such an important decision. And the modern world is more and more moving towards e-commerce. Isn't it a fact? So life is becoming more and more dependent upon Shabda, even without we accepting it on the face. But Jiva Goswami, way back in the 16th century, gave this additional insight that though we might look for Anuman Praman, ultimately our life is dependent upon Shabda. But then Jiva Goswami goes a step further, that anyway your life is based on Shabda, try to base your life on authoritative verbal testimony, that is Shabda from the Shastras. So what we have done basically is we have analyzed a problem from the modern scientific point of view, got a clue of the same analysis from an ancient authority, and trying to analyze the solution which that authority is giving. So Jiva Goswami basically says that anyway your life is based more and more on Shabda, try to base your life on authoritative verbal testimony or Shabda based on the Shastras. Now if we see the Srimad Bhagavatam, what the Srimad Bhagavatam is telling us is, if you base your life on Shabda from the Shastras, slowly, slowly, your life is bound to improve. Now, another definition of an asura which we can get is, an asura is a person who is more and more subjected to cognitive biases, who is absolutely prone to cognitive biases. Such a person is called an asura according to the Srimad Bhagavatam. It is not that the asuras don't have the right understanding any time. Sometimes they do get the right understanding. For example, Jarasandha, when he was defeated, temporarily he got the right understanding. But that period of right understanding was very less. And the period of cognitive bias or thinking mistake was prolonged. So is the case with Kamsa. Kamsa, after Yogamaya appeared to him, he understood that he did a mistake. He got the right understanding. But that period of right understanding was very short. Immediately he got into association of his ministers, and again his understanding became distorted. Cognitive bias. So, a definition of asura is a person who is more and more prone to thinking mistakes and cognitive bias. Most of the times. But less amount of time he gets the right understanding also. On the other hand, asura or a demigod is someone who has got the right understanding most of the time, but is also subjected to cognitive bias once in a while. For example, Brahmaji, he was subjected to cognitive bias when he saw Krishna playing with his cowherd boys. Or Indra was subjected to cognitive bias. That happens once in a while, but most of the time they have got the clear understanding, but sometimes they are subjected to cognitive bias. So on one end are the asuras, who are subjected to cognitive bias most of the times, and on the other end are suras, who are subjected to cognitive bias very less. And everyone else in this world falls somewhere in the middle, in this spectrum. So we are subjected to these biases to a greater or lesser extent. And the whole purpose of the Srimad Bhagavatam is to take us towards that end of the spectrum where the cognitive bias is least. So the goal of the Srimad Bhagavatam in this sense is the same as the goal of modern psychology, to make people proper and sane. And how to do it? The Bhagavatam's solution is, you know, yasya asti bhaktir bhagavati akinchana sarver gunes tatra samasate sura harav bhaktasya kuto mahat guna mano ratena sati dhavato bahi. That anyone who has unflinching devotion to Krishna develops all the godly qualities, or he moves towards that end of the spectrum where the cognitive bias is least, where his thinking is clear. He develops all the godly qualities. And if in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Brahma becomes more specific and he gives a proper understanding of what the solution is. Jnane prayasam udapasya namanteva jivanti san mukharitam bhavadiya vartam sthane stita shrutigatam tanuvak manobhir ye prayaso jita jitopi asitai strilokyam. Basically what he is telling is how to develop this akinchana bhakti through giving up the process of speculation and hearing the absolute shabda, the shabda from the shastras with a submissive disposition, as Jiva Goswami is recommending. And then if we follow this process of following the shabda of the shastras and leading our life based on the shastras and giving oral submissive reception to the shastras, what's the result? Brahma explains in the second canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Na bharati me anga mrashopa lakshate na vai kvachin me manaso mrashagati na me rishikani patantya satpate yan me radaut kantya vatadrato hari. O Narada, because I have caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with great zeal, whatever I say has never proved to have been false, nor is the progress of mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter. He says, Navai kvachin me manaso mrashagati. My mind is never subjected to cognitive biases. That is what Brahmaji is saying. So, that's it. Thank you. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Any questions?
What purpose does that serve? Do you want me to repeat the question?
Yeah. Can repeat the question.
My question is, why do the living entities have this tendency to make these cognitive biases? Is it to protect the false ego, or why is it that we're so prone to doing that as opposed to just being receptive to Shabda, for example?
It's because of the anarthas, as you rightly said, because of the false ego. So each one of these cognitive biases can be connected to one particular anartha, one or more. So the whole solution is trying to clear the heart of these anarthas. Generally, modern psychology gives a solution on a superficial level of trying to understand intellectually. But unless the heart is free from the anarthas, we are pushed towards falling prey to these cognitive biases. Even though subconsciously we know that we might be wrong. It is said that many of these, cognitive biases, even people on higher ranks of society, they are subjected to. For example, there is something called the halo effect. Halo effect means we have a tendency to go by the externals of a person and take decisions based on that. So it is seen that two prisoners who have been sentenced for the same crime, one of the persons who has got a more charismatic personality, he gets freed earlier. That means the judicial system frees him faster than the other person, even though they have committed the same crime. So even high up at the judicial level, people are subjected to these biases, and it's a serious concern. But somehow, the solution is unknown. And so, we have the solution in the Srimad Bhagavatam of how to actually rectify these cognitive biases. Thank you. Hare Krishna.